Welcome to the Boulder Nutrition Think Tank. This program was recorded in June 2004. It's the second session with Ron Rosedale, where he answers questions about the science of nutrition and health and describes transitions to expect as a person's body adjusts to eating and burning fats. But first, if these programs are new to you, I'm Shelley Schlender, a member of the Think Tank, which was launched in 2004 to educate people about how to reduce the risk or even reverse chronic conditions such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. Each person who joined the Think Tank had some health problem they hoped to correct. Each also wanted to improve community health. We met weekly at the Family Learning Center in Boulder. For our dietary approach, we agreed to try a low-carb, adequate protein, high-fat diet for at least 8 weeks. Each session included a potluck dinner, lots of conversation, plus a lecture or question-answer session.
What, Pilar, can you hand me a spoon, please?
While the Think Tank members waited for Ron to arrive, they ate, they talked, they also did a toast to cod liver oil, which is one of the supplements that's recommended in Ron Rosedale's program.
Wait until everybody's ready.
I'll have like a toast.
Yes, we'll have a toast. A toast of cod liver oil. And we're supposed to have a tablespoon. We have this at night.
Yeah,
three of these.
We chose Carlson's cod liver oil because that's an especially good brand. And we chose to do a toast because a lot of people are afraid of how cod liver oil might taste. One reason that it's recommended by this program is because the high level of essential fatty acids it contains, many people are deficient in. Those essential fatty acids help cellular membranes maintain their resiliency. They also have a good track record for improving joint comfort and flexibility, and also helping with depression and mood disorders.
You mean my mother was right? She always used to make us take this in the winter. I mean, she was less flummoxed.
This or castor?
Cod liver. And she just was, you mean my mother was right?
Yeah. All right, does anyone have any last words before we...
Dequan doesn't have any cod liver.
Yeah, I'm so out of balance right now because I haven't started. I just don't even want
to... You're not going
to... to keep his body in its pristine American state until he starts. Okay, so...
But I'm taking very nasty supplements, so it's not going to be... I've had way worse, trust me.
All right, someone needs to strike a toast to the cod liver oil.
Bottoms up.
Doable.
Yeah, it's doable.
Yeah,
oh, that's easy.
Can I drink one of
the
right
I'll
after?
I'll have another.
Yeah, I could do another, actually.
Oh, here, have some more.
All right.
Wow.
You want to do the honors?
Yeah, that's right.
Just
see
that
everybody else
lining up.
That's potential boulder.
It is.
You can do that. Next an oxygen bar.
Right. Cod liver oil bar.
Different flavors of cod liver oil. This is a single malt cod liver oil.
Thus ends our toast to cod liver oil. Up next, Ron Rosedale has his second meeting with the Boulder Nutrition Think Tank. He talks more about his dietary approach, answers questions, and explains what changes to anticipate as people's bodies adjust to eating and burning more fat.
Hello, everyone. How is everyone doing? Okay. Today I thought we could just start fine-tuning what's going on. We still need to... kind of make appointments with each of you, just a short appointment so that we can see if a particular person has a particular need, especially pertaining to medications. So where are we? Has everybody started the diet? Has everybody started?
Not full blown.
Not full blown.
Kind of did a run around. I'm on day 12.
Okay. I would mention that this isn't really the type of diet that works well halfway. It just makes it really hard on yourself. You either can do it or you don't do it. It doesn't mean that you can't get some benefits for instance, having half the carbs now than you had before. You'll get some benefits. But it's much more difficult to maintain that type of diet. It's much easier to maintain the diet if you don't have starches at all. After a couple of weeks, then you find you don't miss them. Otherwise, you're constantly having to struggle and look at something and try and pull away. It's just a lot more difficult. You really kind of torture yourself if you have half a potato instead of a whole potato. Then you'll just want the whole potato. If you don't have any potatoes for a couple of weeks, then it's no big deal. You'll find, you'll look at it, and you won't crave it anymore. So if you really want to get rid of those cravings, which is really the key when it comes to carbohydrates, it's like alcohol. You really have to treat it like alcohol. And if a person's an alcoholic, they're not going to say, all right, you can have two beers a day, or you can have one scotch a day. You know, you've got to go off of alcohol for a while, and then maybe sometime in the future, you know, some alcoholics can have a little bit of alcohol without, you know, totally becoming alcoholic again. That's more of a rarity, but some alcoholics can do that. Other alcoholics, if they have a little scotch, it's all over again, you know, then they go right back. And you'll find the same thing when it comes to carbohydrates. When we're talking about carbohydrates, I'm talking about now the non-fiber carbohydrates, the carbohydrates that turn to sugar. And the way that works is that sugar is burned preferentially to fat. If there's sugar available, your body's going to burn it. So if you have sugar and fat, your body's going to burn the sugar. If you get your body used to burning sugar, it's going to crave it because you don't store it. What you really want to do is you want to introduce your body to burning fat. And if it does that for a week or two, it becomes very good at burning fat. And then it doesn't need the sugar anymore, at least not very much of it. And then you don't crave it. But if you start having sugar again, you're going to make your body burn it again. And then it will crave it again. And that's exclusive of what one does to the hormones that are very important that we talked about, insulin and leptin and things like that. The more foods that turn into sugar, the more insulin and leptin resistant you become. And then you start, you know, fouling up your metabolism again. So I would encourage all of you for just at least 2 weeks, and it will take some willpower. Now, there's supplements. We have some supplements that we will give out. We don't have all of the supplements for everybody today. We had what we had in the office. We just brought it. We'll have to bring the remainder next week. I think we didn't have any L-carnitine, so we'll bring that next week and things like that. But we have some, at least, to get some people started.
Will you be arranging our supplements dependent on the results back on the blood tests, or just blanketing us?
That's a good question. To begin with, you're just going to be blanketed.
Okay.
You're going to be taking supplements that I think everybody should take. And then if there is a particular need, depending on the blood test, for instance, if we find somebody's particularly insulin resistant or in a diabetic, there are other things that we can add to help control the blood sugar and to improve insulin sensitivity and things like that. But what we're giving people are things that would be helpful whether you're the healthiest person in the world.
I've been doing the diet since Saturday.
Okay.
And I'm very tired.
Right. Okay. And that we probably should have told you will likely occur, especially if you're not taking supplements. Your body is used to burning sugar. You're not giving it the sugar to burn, and you're not yet capable of burning fat efficiently. So it's actually quite common to be a little bit tired for the first week or two, and then you'll see almost a day-by-day increase in your energy level after that. The supplements generally will help, but that's quite common because we're taking away the fuel that your body is used to burning, and it takes a couple weeks to transition into burning fat properly. And there's only two fuels your cells can burn. They can burn sugar, they can burn fat. Right now they're not capable of burning fat very well, and you're not giving it the sugar. So you're not going to have the fuel. And you can virtually expect to be tired. Not everybody experiences that, but it's common. And in, I would say, 95% of the cases, it goes away in 2 to 3 weeks, gradually. But the first week is the hardest. Now, some of it can be also, you might require potassium. And I think we have some. Just make sure that we get you some potassium.
Some there's of the no natural source of it in this in the accepted.
Well, there is some, but you're going to need more than you need to ever get naturally. And that's where the supplements really come in handy. Foods these days are really watered down as far as their nutritional content, even the best of the foods. Even you know, organic nuts, and nuts are among the most nutrient-dense foods that there are going to have fewer nutrients now than they had 100 years ago. The soils just don't have the nutrients in them anymore. But we're using some of these nutrients pharmaceutically, you know, in pharmaceutical doses, in treatment doses. Just like if you were on a diuretic, you would get a potassium drug. You know, K-Dur is common, which is a drug, a prescription. And that's because you need to replenish the potassium that you would lose via the diuretic. When your insulin levels fall, you will diurese. And if a person pays attention to their weight, you can lose sometimes 10 pounds that first week. That's not fat. There's no way a person can lose 10 pounds of fat a week.
Water weight.
It's water. And with that water comes a lot of minerals. And the primary among that is potassium. And when your potassium level falls, you feel tired. So you will need extra potassium.
And the things I'm familiar with in foods, like bananas or beets, those are not good.
Right. You're not going to be taking those. Okay. Right. And you wouldn't get enough potassium for your needs right now anyway.
What do you suggest for potassium supplements?
I would suggest potassium aspartate, which is what you'll get in a pill.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've noticed, I had this similar observation, but what I noticed as I sat with it is that it wasn't that I was tired, but I wasn't wired.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I was more relaxed, more mellow. And I can do the things I normally do. I worked out every day. I did my normal lifts. Some of the aerobic stuff was down a little bit, but everything else was the same. Mm-hmm. But I just felt a little bit more even.
Right. You're probably experiencing something a little bit different. Your insulin level, my guess would be, wasn't initially as high. And your name again was?
Sam.
Sam and?
Marcus.
That's right. Your insulin level probably wasn't as high as Marcus's, so you probably didn't have the huge crash in insulin that he did. And one of the things that we want to accomplish is a shift in autonomic nervous system activity from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic. And that's what you see, you know, that's what yogis experience, you know, with alpha waves. Parasympathetic nervous system, you know, the autonomic nervous system is a fight or flight nervous system. You know, it's the nervous system that they call it autonomic because it's supposed to be automatic. You know, you don't have to think about it and you're still able to breathe. Your heart's going to still beat. You don't have to kind of think, beat. You know, it just does it automatically. But you have two portions of it. You have the sympathetic, which is the more fight or flight. You know, that's the one where, you know, if you're panicking and you've got to, you know, run away from a lion, it's going to pump sugar into your system and it's going to make your heart beat harder and it's going to constrict your blood vessels to raise your blood pressure. And that's good for emergencies, but it's not good when you're just sitting here. And one of the huge detriments of being insulin resistant and having a lot of sugar and being forced to burn sugar by eating it is that it stimulates the sympathetic nervous system. In other words, the fight or flight pushes sugar out because that's supposed to be your turbocharger fuel. You know, you can burn that without oxygen. That's an anaerobic fuel. And so when you have a bunch of sugar in your system, your body thinks it's in sympathetic mode, and it will act that way. And that's the stimulated, artificially elevated, you know, that's like being on speed. And it can feel good short term, but if you're on it chronically, you're going to go up and down. You go up and then you'll crash. And it's decidedly unhealthy. It's like having a car, you know, a turbocharged car that's constantly in turbocharger mode. That engine's not going to last as long. And you want to be in parasympathetic mode. In fact, one of the tests now that is becoming more standard among cardiologists is to actually test for the so-called R-to-R interval on the EKG, and it actually is an index of parasympathetic versus sympathetic activity. And one of the parameters that is associated with longevity is an increase in parasympathetic. That's the calm type of nervous system mode as opposed to the sympathetic. So What I'm hoping that you are experiencing is a diminution, a reduction in leptin. And a reduction in leptin is known to be associated with an increase in parasympathetic, the calm nervous system activity. That also lowers your blood pressure. It can lower your heartbeat. It just allows your body to burn fuel very efficiently and in a calm manner. And you'll live longer and healthier. You can think more clearly. It's associated with less anxiety and possibly less brain damage with aging, such as Alzheimer's and things like that, because you're burning ketones as opposed to glucose in your brain.
I went out to eat yesterday at a restaurant that I wasn't familiar with, and we were short on time. So I went into this restaurant, and as soon as I got in to take my order, it was one of those, it's like a, you have to stand in line to get your food. The cook says we're out of salad. So I looked on the menu, and the only thing I could see is barbecue chicken sandwich. So I thought, okay, I'll have the barbecue chicken sandwich without the bread.
And like you noticed something from that barbecue.
Well, so then I got down, I ate it, and I'm like, I felt like I was on speed.
Right.
I realized, my God, the barbecue sauce is
right.
full of sugar.
Right.
And it just really picked me up. I couldn't believe how much difference it was. I really noticed that the sugar in that ingredient was so much.
Yeah.
One other question I want to ask you is, what I've noticed also is a pretty significant change in my stool consistency and color. And I don't know if you want to speak to that, about what that may be a sign of.
We were talking a lot about poop before you got there.
Okay. Well, good. Go ahead and, give me the shit.
The first day, actually, literally at Friday, my stools changed colors. They were actually white or yellow, and they were all floating.
Okay.
I know it's high fat content.
Right, that's high fat content. And that's probably what it is. And in fact, I'm far from a master of Chinese medicine, but I know that in Chinese medicine, they say if you have stools that float, you're healthier. And this goes way back. They didn't know carbohydrates versus fat and things like that, but they knew that if your stools floated, it was a healthier thing for you. If you had two or three bowel movements a day of stools that floated, it was a good thing. And if you had rock hard stool that just kind of sank to the bottom, that's not so good. As far as the color, it's kind of hard to say. But as long as you don't have diarrhea, sometimes in the transition from a high carb to a high fat, you can get very soft stools, even frank diarrhea, because your body is not used to digesting fat. We've been told not to eat fat for so long that the portion of your digestive system that has to digest fat and the lipase from your pancreas has just been basically stagnant and gotten lazy. And it takes a little while to build up. So sometimes when a person goes to a higher fat diet, if you're eating a lot of nuts or avocados or olive oil and things like that, there are some people, and you might have noticed it, they can't digest it. And that olive oil will just kind of go right through you. And that's one reason that some people can get tired too, because you'll eat the fat, but you're not able to really utilize it, not only on a cellular level, but even on a digestive level. But I think you'll notice if you just keep going, part of that adaptation will be with your digestive system. Your pancreas will kind of upregulate its production of lipase, which allows you to digest fat more efficiently. Your gallbladder will produce more bile. And maybe paradoxically, I don't look at it paradoxically, but many people might. If you eat a high oil diet, your incidence of gallbladder, gallstones, and gallbladder disease goes way down because you're using it. When you eat a fat or an oil, there's a reflex, a neurological reflex that causes your gallbladder to constrict and empty its contents. And here's a true example of use it or lose it. If you don't use your gallbladder because you're eating a very low-fat diet, that bile just stagnates. Stagnation is not good. If your urine stagnates, you're going to get a bladder infection. If a pond stagnates, it's going to grow all sorts of bugs. You certainly don't want your circulation to stagnate. You want things have to flow. You know, and actually, you know, we can go into physics of that. You know, flow is actually what causes anything to exist, truly. Anything exists only because the universe is expanding. Things have to move. And if you can cause your, if you can get your gallbladder to regularly empty its contents, your risk of having large gallstones form inside of it are greatly, greatly diminished. But you also need that bile to digest fats. And so it takes a little while to get your gallbladder even in shape to expel bile and to produce it to emulsify the fats and to be able to utilize it. I think, as I mentioned before, burning sugar versus burning fat is it's a totally different ball game. Totally different ball game. You know, sugar is water soluble and fat is fat soluble. They're transported totally differently in the bloodstream. It's really even more so, much more different than switching a car over from a gasoline powered to a diesel powered. Even though those are both kind of hydrocarbon oil type substances, but when you go from burning something that's water soluble to burning something that's fat soluble, even the transport of that fuel is totally different. The digestion of that fuel is totally different. So, and your body uses totally different apparatus, and that apparatus has to gear up. So there is definitely a transition period, and that transition period is in a young, healthy person, I'd say about 1.5 to 2 weeks. In somebody that's not that healthy, it might take as long as 3 weeks.
So, Ronald, some of what you're saying seems to me like if someone's eating out of hunger, if someone's eating out of stress, or they're eating because they're tired and they want to stay awake instead of just out of habit grabbing food, then even if their body is more geared to metabolizing fats, could they overeat fats and then they get diarrhea?
Yeah. The one of the things, there are other things that feed into this, as it were, as you say. But as Marcus was saying, even that stress level can reduce on this diet. You know, if you change your autonomic nervous system activity, what one of the hopes is that there would be less nervousness and less stress to have to eat out of nervousness and stress. Eliminate the source of that, some of that nervousness and stress. It doesn't mean that, we can eliminate all stress in life. You know, we live in a pretty stressful world, but the way a person deals with that stress, maybe it would take more stress to kind of make your heart beat faster and make you sweat than it otherwise would. So it might make it a little bit easier to cope with that stress if you're not having peaks of blood sugar. I think that the biggest stress, unknowingly, that people go through on a day-to-day basis are the ups and downs of blood sugar. Every time your sugar goes up, it is stressful to you. It is simulating a stressful situation. The same thing will happen to your body when blood sugar elevates that would happen if you got scared. And so there's enough stress in our lives. We don't have to mimic it 5 times a day.
With this ketones thing where we're measuring our urine to see, is the goal to take it all the way down to the most extreme level or just to see where it balances? Or I've seen mine drop, but I'm at midpoint. I'm not all the way down.
Okay. Ketones, and it's funny you should mention that because I just wrote an answer to an email yesterday about ketones. And I was recently at a meeting, and one of the researchers asked me to co-author a paper with them stressing the difference between ketones and ketoacidosis, or ketosis and ketoacidosis, to the medical community. Ketones have gotten a bad name, and that's done through very false information. This is through physicians. Now, you hear that all the time, and you see it in people who say that low carbohydrate diets aren't good because they produce ketosis, and that's really a statement out of ignorance.
I don't even know what ketones are.
I know. Well, I will tell you.
I don't know what ketosis is.
Yeah. Well, ketosis just means you've got ketones in your blood.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And ketones are chemicals, and they are byproducts of fat metabolism. You cannot burn fat without producing ketones. And so, how many physicians would say, well, it's not good to burn fat? Well, nobody. They all want you to burn fat. They say, you know, everybody needs to lose weight. Everybody's becoming obese. Everybody's got high blood pressure and diabetes. And I think it's pretty common knowledge. It's going to get a little controversy that losing weight is going to help people. But they don't want you to lose weight. They want you to lose fat. I mean, they don't want you to lose your bone, and they don't want you to lose your muscle. They want you to lose fat. Well, the only way you're going to lose that fat, and it's not going to just, you know, drop out of your pockets. You know, you got to burn it. And to burn fat, you're going to produce ketones. And ketones are a fuel that your body can use, actually. It's a byproduct of fat metabolism. And your brain burns ketones wonderfully. And it's one of the reasons, it's another one of the reasons why Marcus is feeling a little bit more calm. If every child burned ketones as opposed to sugar, they're not going to be running around the schoolroom. It's a much calmer fuel. They've shown it's a much more, it's a much less damaging fuel. They're putting kids, or even adults now, who have really severe epilepsy, where drugs aren't working, on a so-called ketogenic diet, meaning a diet that produces ketones, a high-fat diet. It's not the best high-fat diet, you know, it's a bunch of whipped cream and stuff like that. But they find that it works better than anything else they can do to eliminate epilepsy, because it's calming. But it doesn't just calm your brain, it calms your heart, it calms all sorts of things. And you could certainly tune up that diet to make it much healthier, even for these kids. But this was first done 20 years ago, and then it fell into disrepute when they said, well, fat's got to be bad for you. We can see that these kids are doing great, but we know fats are bad for you, so, you know, we're not going to use it anymore. And of course, drugs weren't involved in this. But now it's been kind of resurrected in the last 5 years or so, because nothing else was working. So it's the treatment of choice in really severe epilepsy. It's a so-called ketogenic diet. And your brain is one of the primary tissues that can burn ketones. And when you hear bad things about ketones, it's very weird to me, because we evolved burning ketones. We didn't have sugar. You know, we went through periods of feast and famine. That's well accepted. And during every famine, we had to burn fat. You know, we store fat for a reason. We don't store fat because we're trying to get fat. We store fat so that we can burn it on a rainy day. We can burn it next week or next month when we haven't been able to find food. And if you're going to burn those fat stores, you're going to produce ketones. And many of your tissues are going to have to burn those ketones, especially your brain. And we know your brain works great on burning ketones. And that's how your brain exists when there's not sugar around. It burns ketones. So anyway, not to answer your questions, it also takes a little bit of time for your body to get used to burning ketones. It's a little bit of a different fuel. And so when you first go on a diet that is forcing you to break down fats, and you're still not able to burn fat that efficiently, those ketones are going to build up in your blood because you're not able to utilize them very well. And then you're going to spill some of those ketones into your urine. And so for the first week or two on the diet, your ketones in your urine, if you dip it, use the keto sticks, is going to be significant. You know, it's going to be higher. And you've noticed that over time, it starts falling. Not because necessarily you're burning less fat, but because you're able to burn more ketones. And so then they build up less. And then you're not going to become so-called, you know, excessively ketotic. That's perfectly great. We want you to have some ketones, but if you have a whole ton of ketones in your blood, it means you're not able to burn them very well. And it's not so much that the ketones are bad, but the elevation in ketones in your blood, if it's significantly elevated, let's say in the high range, it's not so much that that's going to be that bad for you, but it's significant in that it's telling us that you're not able to burn them very well, and that's not so good.
So at the very start, it wouldn't be surprising if someone had dark red or purple.
Well, I don't think they're going to ever get there, to tell you the truth.
I was at 40 milligrams.
Yeah. You know, you might get to moderate or large, but if you get, you know, 160 or above, that's usually reserved for the type 1 diabetics who are in really poor control.
But then how about if somebody's been on the diet that you're recommending for a while?
Yeah, and you get small to trace, and that would be fairly usual for somebody who is losing weight. Mm. And once somebody gets down to their kind of desired weight, and they're kind of in a standard or in a homeostatic, you know, not losing, not gaining, then probably a trace would be what they might find. Uh-huh. And that would be a good thing. None of you, unless there's a type 1 diabetic here, would ever experience ketoacidosis. Okay, that's when the ketones get so high that your blood becomes acid. You only need a tiny amount of insulin working to prevent that from happening. And so that's only in a, generally you'll see in a newly diagnosed type 1 diabetic whose blood sugars were 700, never knew they had diabetes, and they're in really sad shape. They go into the hospital and they're ketoacidotic, and they have to be given insulin, and it has to be changed kind of gradually. It would be doubtful that anybody in this room would experience that in their entire life. So you don't have to worry too much about it.
What about acid reflux?
Acid reflux is one of the things, actually, that is unheralded, but is one of the most common afflictions that is, for lack of a better term, cured by eliminating carbohydrates.
See, for me, I found...
Was the other way around?
I went off the milk, and it's back. I was on taking 800 milligrams of Zantac twice a day, and now I've cut the dairy out because they put me on dairy to stop it.
For the dairy fat.
Back real bad again.
But you're also off the Zantac.
Yeah. Well, I haven't taken Zantac now for 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Well, again, that'll be one of the things that we'll need to talk about on an individual basis. That's unusual. Because even in the literature now, it's pretty well documented that carbohydrates are one of the major things that cause acid reflux. So you might even be suffering from something that actually goes beyond acid reflux.
Yeah, because I went and bought a gallon of milk last night, and just a glass of milk took care of it.
Yeah, well, it's the fat in the milk. You're talking about full fat milk.
Right, yeah. Full milk only.
Yeah, how about if you took the cod liver oil? Have you tried that?
I didn't have any, no.
Yeah, let's try that. It's the fat in the milk that's coating your stomach. Okay. And there are things that can be a lot better than milk, because milk also still has a lot of sugar.
One is occasional mild burning sensation that's very specifically located in the middle of my back and slightly to the left. The other is occasional mild headaches. None of this is debilitating, mm-hmm. but I'm noticing it this week.
Well, let's see what happens when you go on supplements. There's a lot of things that can happen if your potassium levels go low.
Yeah.
Low potassium.
What's going on with the...
Well, it's hard to say. But one of the things I was just going to say is when your potassium levels go low, it stimulates nerves to fire. Mm-hmm. A person can even get twitches and things like that. You get cramps. And you might be noticing something having to do with low potassium. So let's see what happens. If I don't get to talk to you this week, let's address that next week after you've been on supplements. Mm-hmm. My guess is that once you go on supplements, those symptoms are going to go away. Mm-hmm. I think that quite a bit of what you're experiencing has to do with low potassium.
Some inflammation of mm-hmm. some organ?
Well, I can't really guess mm-hmm. with that right now. But you're probably talking about something that has to do with musculoskeletal rather than an organ, if you can actually point to it. Organ pain is very diffuse. You can't point to it. Yeah, so you were dealing with something that's musculoskeletal, which can be painful but not serious. Mm-hmm. If it were, liver pain or gallbladder pain or pancreas pain, it's real kind of much more diffuse. You can't point to where it is. But people get pancreatitis until it gets really bad. They just have an upset stomach. Mm. You can't point to it. And angina, it's another heart pain. In fact, we're taught in medical school that one of the major things, someone goes to the emergency room and they say they have chest pain, first thing you got to think about is that person having a heart attack. And you ask them, point to it. And if they can point to it, it's not heart attack. And it's not heart pain. Then it's a musculoskeletal pain. Questions? Kidney stones. You can get kidney stones, but you're not going to be more prone. That is something that people say with a low carb diet, but it's not low carb that's doing it. You can be more predisposed to kidney stones with high protein. Now, this is not a high protein diet. I want to stress that each time. It's not a high protein diet. And we just presented some evidence, actually, that shows that creatinine levels fall, which indicates that kidney function actually gets better when a person follows this type of diet. But kidney stones can come from a wide variety of reasons. A lot of it has to do with acidosis. Too much calcium can cause kidney stones. Too much phosphorus can cause kidney stones. Citrate, you know, a lot of things can cause kidney stones, but it won't have anything to do with the diet. I haven't noticed kidney stones being a problem with the diet over the last 15 years at all.
Does lowering the insulin and leptin level also help in prostate health?
That's a very good, it seems like I planted you there for that question. there are, for instance, cases now, and I've had it myself, not prostate cancer, but I've treated prostate cancer with a very low carbohydrate diet. One of the main things about cancer, we'll talk about cancer a little bit. What everybody has to understand about cancer, including the medical community, is cancer cells are very healthy cells, and they are not abnormal cells. They are very healthy, very normal cells. Anything that you do that would be good for your body would be good for cancer cells. So it makes it difficult when one tries to treat cancer, for instance, nutritionally. But there is one thing that you can use in cancer, and that is that they are rapidly dividing cells. So from a cellular level, they're into anaerobic activity. In other words, they're exercising really hard to have to divide that fast. They're utilizing energy very quickly. And that means that the most aggressive cancers are obligate glucose users. It's like we use glucose. We have to burn sugar when we're going into anaerobic metabolism. That means without oxygen. So too are cancer cells. And they've shown pretty convincingly, if you keep sugar low, you're going to inhibit the growth of cancer. Another thing is that insulin itself is a growth promoter. And if you keep insulin levels low, that you will inhibit the growth of cancer cells. But when you can do both of those by not taking in sugar. And they actually treated, there was a relatively kind of well-known study, I think it's not that well-known, but among certain people it's well-known, kind of a famous study, done in the 70s of half a dozen or so women who had very advanced stage breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, that were no longer considered candidates for any type of medical therapy, drug or surgical or otherwise. And they were experimented on when this information was becoming known, and they were basically put daily into a diabetic coma, where their sugars were put really low, 30s. And four of those six women were alive 20 years later, which nobody felt would have ever been possible. But there were no drugs involved in this. So it wasn't a popular treatment. No money was being made, although they're continuing, at least anecdotally, successfully doing it in Mexico. Now, what you're hearing is somewhat theoretical when I talked about sugar and insulin, but there was an article about a year ago, and it was the first to show, although they've shown that low-carbohydrate diets, or that high-carbohydrate diets, I should say, are correlated with increased incidences of almost any cancer. That high-carbohydrate diets are associated with high levels of colon cancer and breast cancer and lung cancer and pancreatic cancer. But about a year ago, it was the first study that showed, and this was incidence of cancer, what I'm talking about. But there was a study a year ago that showed that a low carbohydrate diet was used successfully to treat prostate cancer. Probably for the reasons that I gave, that it kept sugar and insulin levels low. And we know prostate cancer is kind of a slow-growing cancer anyway, so you have a little time to intervene. So anyway, to answer your question, this type of diet is tailor-made for cancer.
What about the fat piece with the cancers then? Has that been studied as well as
kind of beyond? You mean the kind of fat that's used?
Well, we're kind of beyond low-carb. We're kind of no-carb, so it hits it there. But has specifically the fat...
Well, you're not on no-carb. you're on as little non-fiber carb as possible. You're still eating vegetables and things like that, and those are carbohydrates. So you're into a good carbohydrate as opposed to bad carb, or as little non-fiber carbohydrate as possible. As far as the type of fat that's being used to treat cancer, there are a number of studies that somewhat conflicting as to which fats are best for cancer, and it's a little bit different story if you're trying to prevent cancer versus treat cancer. One of the things I mentioned is that polyunsaturated fats oxidize readily, and fish oil is one of the more highly oxidizable fats. Fish oil, though, can be very good for you. It's necessary. In fact, it's an essential nutrient. You know, EPA and DHA are essential nutrients. You have to have them. But they do oxidize very readily. And we know that they get incorporated into cell membranes. And it makes those cell membranes healthy in that it allows them to be more fluid so that nutrients can get in and out more readily. But there's a downside to any polyunsaturated fat in that it can oxidize. And so you have to take extra fat-soluble antioxidants to prevent that fat from oxidizing. In other words, it'll turn rancid easily. And they've shown that if you don't protect fish oil or any polyunsaturated oil, it will allow your cells to turn rancid more easily. So what they did, they used this knowledge in mice that they had induced tumors, and they gave them a diet that was high in fish oil and high in iron. Iron is an oxidation promoter. It rusts easily. And they withheld vitamin E. So they withheld the fat-soluble antioxidants, and they gave a prooxidant in iron and fish oil. And they found that they could blast those tumors away. But basically what's happening is the fish oil is being incorporated in some membrane, and then the iron was causing it to oxidize very rapidly, and those cells were essentially exploding. It's really a form of chemotherapy.
For pennies on the dollar.
Right, for pennies on the dollar, and it was a very highly effective chemotherapy. So there, the fish oil was being used as a chemotherapeutic agent. And I think one of the things I might have mentioned, if I didn't, that fat can be your best friend or your worst enemy, depending on the context. So the same thing, I'm sure, was happening to other cells in that mouse. But since cancer cells were rapidly dividing and rapidly producing, that the fish oil was being preferentially incorporated into the reproducing cancer cells and into the other cells that were reproducing less rapidly. So they were dying at a faster rate. So, you know, which fats to use when one is talking about cancer is still open to debate. And it kind of depends on, I think, whether you have cancer or whether you're trying to prevent having it. But I would say that just the fact that you're really reducing your carbohydrates, I think that the evidence there is really pretty clear that you greatly reduce your risk of breast cancer. In Italy, there was a study, an epidemiologic study, that showed that pasta intake was directly correlated with breast cancer incidence. So the more pasta people ate, women ate, the higher their incidence of breast cancer, which was kind of interesting. And again, most likely for the same reasons that I gave. You're just fueling. Everybody has cancer, by the way. Cancer is a common occurrence. You just want to be able to gobble it up and prevent it from spreading. I mean, you've got cancer cells that are forming right now. So do I. Everybody does. We've got 10 trillion cells. They're not going to all behave perfectly. There's going to be some unruly cells among those 10 trillion cells all at a time. But we have an immune system, and the neighbors give those cancer cells signals to commit suicide. There are checkpoints for cancers, and as long as those checkpoints are working properly, that cancer's just not going to make it very far. But if you strengthen that cancer cell, you know, if you keep feeding it the fuel it needs, and if you give it growth promoters like insulin, it might be able to overcome those checkpoints. And that's when you can come down with clinical cancer. So
I haven't started any diet or anything, and where is exercise in all this? I'm hearing that for the first 2 weeks you feel kind of tired.
Well, you can exercise. I consider exercise to be kind of a morning after pill. Exercise can cover up a lot of mistakes in diet. The major benefit of exercise to me is that it lowers blood sugar and insulin. You know, if you're going to eat it, it's best to get rid of it as fast as possible. And if you exercise, you burn it away so that it might only be around for an hour rather than 3 or 4 hours. And that then limits your cells' exposure to insulin, which would limit your cells' ability to become more insulin resistant. It gets rid of the sugar faster so that sugar doesn't combine with the proteins in your body as rapidly, glycation. It's best not to put it in your system in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if I had to choose one of two lifestyles, if I have to either choose a low-carbohydrate diet or the diet I'm recommending, not a high-protein diet, if I had to choose the ROSA diet or the standard diet with exercise, who would be healthier? There's no question in my mind that you're better off not having it in the first place. And you'd be a whole lot healthier if you eat my diet and don't exercise than you would if you exercise like a fiend and ate the typical American diet. But you can actually take the ROSA diet a little bit step further if you exercise a little bit on top of it. And I'm not a big advocate of lots of exercise, but 20 minutes a day of mild exercise, of anything you like to do, really, I don't think it matters that much. To me, the best exercise would be mild resistance training, you know, where you exercise your muscles a little bit. So walking uphill would be a little better than walking on a flat surface, a few calisthenics. Yoga, to me, is a wonderful exercise because it's a non-stressful form of exercise. Mm-hmm. And what you'll find in some diabetics, it's a common history in the severe diabetics, in the type 1 diabetics. They'll exercise and their blood sugar will go up. That's kind of paradoxical, but that's because it's a stress. Mm-hmm. And so their sympathetic nervous system is kicking in and causing a breakdown of their muscle tissue and turning it into sugar. And then it's obviously not a good thing. So exercise can actually be bad for you. It's not altogether good. But if they were to do yoga, that's not going to happen. Because that's a, right, especially the, well, the milder types, you know, the more meditative types of yoga, hatha yoga, as opposed to the
Bikram.
Strenuous, yeah, Bikram. They've shown actually also that this type of diet can enhance athletic performance because it teaches you how to burn fat efficiently so you don't just rely on sugar. People who exercise and you hear about hitting the wall, you know, you run a mile, so you hit the wall and you just drop. It's because they're not able to dig into the fat stores. And when they run out of sugar, which you can do very rapidly, then you don't have a fuel to burn. If you train your body to burn fat efficiently, you're not going to hit a wall. As soon as you run out of sugar, then you'll dig into your fat stores and you'll still have a fuel you can use. It doesn't give you the, you can't use fat like you would use sugar in an anaerobic, mm-hmm. but you'll have something. And it's best to be able to use both.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's good for everybody. I don't think there's a living being of any kind. I mean, they're showing this is good for life extension, as I mentioned, in worms and flies. And they've found even, for instance, in Down syndrome, that this type of diet is really good for. That it doesn't get rid of the Down syndrome, but they do much better and actually live longer.
How about ADHD? Has there been any studies with that? Right?
Yeah, I think I mentioned that earlier, that it calms your brain. Okay. Well, I said, you know, in kids, you know, the hyperactive kids in school, if they get rid of their carbohydrates, they're much more calm.
And they can concentrate.
And they can concentrate much more. Yeah.
I can almost see.
No candy.
Yeah. In fact, it's virtually a cure for that.
When we were talking about kidney stones a little while ago, I wonder.
At this point, we don't really know what causes kidney stones. Yeah. You know, as much as there's a lot of information about it, there's a lot of factors probably that lead into it. One thing for sure that is known is that, and I'm a guilty of it as much as the next person, if you don't drink enough water, you're going to cause stagnation. And then certain you know, minerals and other chemicals you have floating around your kidney are going to precipitate. It would not happen if there was flow, you know, flow through, just like gallstones. My guess is it's very similar to gallstones. We know gallstones form if the gallbladder is not constricted regularly, and the bile just kind of stagnates in there, and it basically just kind of dries up, and you get a precipitate. And the same thing will happen in your kidneys if you don't drink enough fluid. Thank you. But everybody should be drinking, and certainly with this diet, I'd recommend drinking a lot of water.
Do you expect that people will stay on the diet for their lives, or?
Good question.
Okay, insulin resistance is definitely reversible. Up to a point. Insulin resistance itself is reversible. The amount of insulin that your pancreas is able to produce to overcome that resistance is limited.
Yeah.
And with age, your ability to compensate for insulin resistance diminishes. And therefore, your propensity to become diabetic increases with age. So the more you are insulin resistant, the more you're going to stress out your islet cells to compensate, the more you're going to kill some of those islet cells, and the less you're going to be able to compensate for that insulin resistance into the future. And your next question was, should you remain on this the rest of your life? It just depends on how healthy you want to be. As I mentioned, once you're on it for a while, it's not that hard. It's really, there's no reason not to, you'll see. It's not that much of an imposition after you've been on it for a month or so. Once you've been doing this for a month or 2 months, and you get kind of used to it, you get used to eating nuts, and you look at bread and it doesn't have the appeal anymore, or potatoes, there's no reason not to.
It's the fruit.
Yeah.
It's the fruit.
Well, even the fruit. It's the sugar. Yeah, it's your sugar. And you're craving sugar. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I don't even think about it anymore. I think about it now, I used to love bananas and apples. And I haven't had a banana in a decade, I suppose. And I don't think I've had an apple. And apples aren't the worst thing. You can have half apple. I don't think I've had an apple in 2 years. I have blueberries sometimes. It's probably been 6 months since I've had any blueberries. It's just something I don't even think of anymore, to tell you the truth. It's just not that big a deal. And you'll see, your cravings really change. What you want to eat is going to change. And so you're not going to always have to, bite your mouth and feel like it's a horrible thing not having fruit, unless you keep having it.
Right.
And that's why I say it's much easier just to forego it than to have a little bit. But even on this diet, you can have some blueberries. The problem is, if it keeps making you want other fruits, then that's not so good. In our ancient cultures, when we ate fruit, we did not eat them like we eat them now. Mm-hmm. If we ate an apple, first of all, it was only in season, and it was fortuitous because most of the time it was in the fall when most of the fruit was available, and it was prior to the winter time, and then it was good to make fat out of it. You wanted to become actually a little insulin resistant, and you wanted to get fat, because you weren't going to stay fat for long, because you weren't going to have that much to eat in the coming months when winter came around. Also, when that apple was eaten, we didn't bother taking a knife and peeling it and taking the core. Just the whole thing was eaten.
Also, the apples that we know are relatively recent.
Right, they're relatively recent. Older apples were much smaller.
Yeah.
They had more skin to volume, less sugar, and you'd eat the whole thing. Yeah. You'd eat the seeds and you'd eat the skin. And the seeds and the skin have good nutrients.
And I have spent time trying to pick actual wild blueberries, and to get even half a cup takes a very long time.
Right, and you're going to expend more energy. I know.
Yeah.
One at a time. I used to do that when I was living in...
this big.
in Asheville, North Carolina. Oh, yeah, you're gonna expend more energy than you're going to get from eating them. Plus, if you eat them while you're picking them, you're going to be burning it. It's not gonna build up. Yeah. So it's a little bit different than, going to the store and just buying 3 pounds of blueberries that somebody else has picked. Controlling insulin and leptin is what will determine a laboratory animal's health and longevity. It's as simple as that. And you will become less, a little bit less insulin resistant if you don't have fats with your carbohydrates. So if you're going to eat a high carbohydrate diet, you better not eat fat with it. Because if you eat a high carbohydrate diet, you're going to raise your insulin, and you're going to burn the sugar, and you're going to store the fat. So eating fats with sugar is a recipe for disaster. Then you'll get fat. There's no question about it, because you can't burn any of it. So a high carbohydrate, low fat diet is better than a high fat, high carbohydrate diet. But it's not anywhere close to as good as a low carbohydrate, moderate protein, and then just eat enough fat to appease your appetite. The fat you really want to be burning is the fat you want your cells to be eating is the fat that you've got stored. The only way you're going to do that is to learn how to burn fat. And you're not going to really learn how to burn fat on a high sugar diet or a high sugar promoting diet. It's just never going to happen. And I would think that in the future, I will tell you unequivocally that a low carbohydrate diet is not a fad. I mean, it's supported by lots and lots of good scientific information. It's going to be here for a long time. Consequently, there are going to be more foods eaten that support a low carbohydrate diet. So the volume is going to increase, and therefore the cost is going to go down. For instance, if more people ate almonds, and then there'd be more almonds produced, more almonds grown, which takes a few years for it to catch up, the different costs from supply and demand, the cost is going to go down. You're going to find then the cost of almonds are going to go way down. They could be half of what they are now. There's really not a whole lot of reason for almonds to cost a lot more than corn, other than the lag time.
You know, it's a crop that has less tillage, so it's mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to do much to it.
It's dependent on bees. And it's dependent on bees.
Totally. Good.
Should we do some, do you have the body mass?
I do, so why don't we go ahead and start that, because it's already getting a little bit late. So let's, if we can, I'll give you that.
And I was just wondering if we make a lot of weight.
This is an ideal diet for weightlifting. Uh-huh. Not just for energy, but for actually, for building mass.
Okay.
There are some bodybuilders that actually take insulin.
Yeah.
It's actually a fad in bodybuilding, because they find they can build muscle.
Really?
It's legal. Because insulin is a growth promoter.
Okay.
And not just for fat, but also for muscle. But it's much better, rather than take insulin, because then what you're going to do is become insulin resistant.
Right.
Then you just need more and more, and then you're going to drop your sugar and you can't take anymore.
Right.
You know, they get too hypoglycemic. If you improve your insulin sensitivity, you'll increase muscle mass. One of the things we've seen with patients, whether they exercise or not, the majority of patients increase lean body mass. So when a person, if you just were to go by your scale at home, you might find, after you've lost your body fluid and things kind of settle in a little bit, you find you might lose a half a pound in a week. You're saying, gosh, this is really going slow. But you said, I thought I was really doing better than that, because my clothes are fitting more loosely than just a half a pound a week. But when you measure your body comp, you find that you lost 3 pounds of fat and you gained 2.5 pounds of muscle or something like that. The difference is only half a pound, but the difference in body composition is quite a bit. So you're going to gain lean body mass as you're losing fat. And that we find whether you, even if you don't exercise. And that has to do with insulin sensitivity. Yeah, isn't that great? You don't have to do anything.
Weird.
And you build muscle. Hormones, I think one of the things I mentioned when I gave my talk, everything your body does is done by direction. They found that out with testosterone. They gave, you know, relatively well-known study I think men in their 50s. They gave them testosterone. They had several groups. They had a control group, and they had a group that took testosterone, and then they had a group that exercised, and then they had a group that took testosterone and exercised. And the interesting part, the control group that didn't do anything actually lost a little bit of lean body mass over the duration of the study, which I think was 6 months or something like that. The group that exercised, I think, gained 2 pounds of muscle. The group that took testosterone gained 5 pounds of muscle. And the group that took testosterone plus exercise gained 9 pounds. So of course they did the best. But the interesting part is, the group that took testosterone and didn't exercise at all,
right,
did better than the group that exercised, actually double as well. which is just kind of testimony to how important hormones are. If you got the right hormones, you're going to do what you're supposed to do, really.
So if your cells are listening more to the low levels of hormones, it does the same thing as raising them.
Well, it does better because it'll keep that activity over a longer period of time.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're listening to high levels, you're going to become, you know, deaf to those high levels over time.
These supplements, these are a bridge as our body makes this adjustment, or are these things?
You can use them as a bridge. If a person could afford them, they have benefits, you know, for the rest of your life, if you wanted to. You don't have to.
Yeah, I mean,
but I would say certainly for the first couple of months, it's a good idea to be on.
So we can't get what we need from this diet, though, if you're saying take these for the rest of our life?
Well, it depends. What when you say need is a relative term. I'm asked, how would I rate the relative importance of diet and exercise and supplements? And I would usually say, you know, diet would be 70% of it. And, you know, supplements might be 20% and exercise 10%. If a person ate the right diet. So exercise can offer you a little bit of benefit. But I think exercise offers you, you know, basically it just helps minimize the damage from a bad diet. But if you don't have the bad diet in the first place, you don't have to minimize that damage.
But what about the for example, for women, they recommend that you have to exercise.
I know, and they also recommend a high carbohydrate diet. They've also, you know, they recommend all sorts of things. They recommend taking calcium. None of these have any merit whatsoever. In fact, they will, you know, taking calcium will be harmful for you, and actually will be harmful for your bones and not helpful. Mm-hmm. They've shown that by far the most important factor in maintaining strong bones is your leptin levels. Mm-hmm. And if you keep leptin low, you're going to have strong bones. And it won't make any difference whether you exercise or how much calcium you take. If you eat a diet that will maintain low leptin, which means high leptin sensitivity, you're going to have strong bones. But that's new science. They don't even know it yet.
A dietitian once told me, when discussing a possible dietary change, what matters is what you do 80% of the time. Is that accurate? I mean, I'm sort of looking for an excuse to backslide, I guess, but...
Yeah,
you know,
well, it depends
on one day a week
on the person. It's like, again, I'll have to go back to the analogy of an alcoholic. You know, if you have an alcoholic and you tell them don't eat alcohol 80% of the time, which means they can drink alcohol 20% of the time, it's not going to stay 20% of the time.
Or they may binge.
If you could do that, it would be okay. Then you'd be 80% as healthy as you could be. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you're not going to do that. If you eat carbohydrates, you know, if 20% of your meals, you eat whatever you feel like eating. You know, you say, I'm going to go ahead and eat brownies and an apple pie and you know, whatever you feel like. All you're going to do is you're going to make yourself crave those things during your other meals. And you're going to torture yourself. And I don't think you're going to be able to maintain that.
But, well, that question, is there a place in the world for apple pie?
You know, that's you're talking about one of my favorites.
The
question is, you can. I mean, you're not going to kill yourself if you go to a birthday party and had a piece of birthday cake. Yeah. You'll find, though, that you're not going to want it as much if you stay away from it. And you'll also find that it'll be like an abuse in an alcoholic. You know, you're going to get sick. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Marcus was saying, you know, he just really, the repercussions of it become more apparent to you, mm-hmm. which makes it less appealing the next time, mm-hmm. unless you keep doing it.
It may be a matter of picking and choosing, like a teacher is constantly around birthday parties. Mm-hmm. If a person with their family just chose their own family's birthday parties, then it would be, what, 6 times a year. So,
there's things you can do. For instance, if you're going to cheat, cheat in a healthy way. They have now really good low-carb ice cream. You know, Ben and Jerry's has a really good low-carb ice cream, and I just tried it to see if I could recommend it. What's it called? Carb
just
Karma.
Just to see that's
right. That's right. Exactly. It's becoming healthier to cheat as people are coming out with more products. But the problem is that it makes you crave it more. And so, you know, then you eat five times as much of it, which is still going to be really bad for you.
And a lot of them, they're limiting sugars, but they're putting like
sugar alcohols and sorbitol, which is really bad for you, especially diabetics.
Right.
It causes nerve damage and things like that. As I'm saying, it isn't good for you by any means, but it is still probably better for you than the non-low carb version of it. But if you find yourself having it once a month and then once a week and then once a day, you know, then every day, then it's not going to work for you. And all things being equal, they have low carb pastas now. They're really pretty good. You know, low carb noodles.
Mm-hmm.
Pasta is the one food actually that is relatively easy to make low carb. The glycemic index of regular pasta is not all that horrible. It's not the best for you, but you can get low carbohydrate pasta that tastes quite good, and you can get very low sugar versions of pasta sauce that are available. They're also very, very good. I think I find them much more appealing anyway.
I love fried fish and fried chicken. And like, I don't struggle with desserts. It's that. That's what I struggle with.
Fried foods.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, fried foods is decidedly horrible.
Yeah. So there's no good way to do that, is what you're basically saying.
Yeah, there's really no
good choice.
You know, you don't eat too much of it anyway because you eat too much protein. You got to watch the high protein.
Right.
That's one detriment. There is a way you could do it. You know, you could just lightly fry it in olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that.
All right.
You just can't bread it.
I know.
You can't bread it.
What's the point of frying it?
It doesn't soak up.
But again, for all of you people, you know, it's if you stay away from it, just don't have it. You know, it's like a phone number. If you, like, you go back to an old phone number that, you know, you had a house that you lived in 10 years ago. You don't call that phone number for 10 years. You don't remember it. But you come across an old receipt that has your phone number. Then you remember it for the next month until you have to forget it again. The same type of thing. If you just don't even taste that fried food, you don't think about it, you don't look at it, you forget it.
See, I have a great memory. I still right now, you know? So if you can give me a supplement that decreases memory.
Decreases your memory. The best is just...
Where do you draw the line for low carb? Like Tiffany, when she was here, she was talking about these tortillas that are three grams.
Right, that would be fine. Some of it is the type of sugar that it is. And we're not saying necessarily that the tortilla is good, but if a person has to have some sort of bread-like product where they can use it as a platform and it allows you to help maintain the diet, that's great. The salad dressing is sugar, as opposed to, you know, the... On the tortilla, it doesn't have a sweet taste. It's not going to perpetuate sweet cravings necessarily, especially 3 grams. And digesting it alone is going to take more. It's going to use that 3 grams of sugar just to supply the energy to digest it.
You want to go less than 7 grams.
Per day? What is it? I'm sorry.
I think that's what she had mentioned, like 7 grams.
I mean, if you really want to count, I don't, you know, to me, counting is cumbersome. You just want to eat as little non-fiber carbohydrates as you can that will allow you to maintain the diet. It basically what you want to do.
Well, the other reason why I brought it up is when she talked about her tortillas, I guess they looked and said they were, what, 3 grams of carbs?
Well, they're 12 grams of carbohydrate, 9 of which are fiber. So it gives you something, it gives you some bulk. You know, you're eating something, and yet
so the
entire tortilla, which is fairly filling, will only give you 3 grams of non-fiber carbohydrate.
Right.
So you'll be filled up with it.
Well,
whereas it's a different, like if you just had half a teaspoon of sugar, you're getting the same amount of carbohydrate.
And,
but you're not going to get filled up, and it's going to be pure sugar, and you're just going to crave it more, so you're not going to be satiated at all.
Well, I bought the Mission style, and they have 7 grams as compared to...
Right, so that, number one, it wouldn't be as good. And number two, I think they have partially hydrogenated oils, or they have soybean oil, or some kind of bad oil in there. I looked at the ingredients and it wasn't near as good.
On the mission?
On the mission.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to hear this because I see that you're looking at the labels and that's what you need to do.
Vitamin or supplement? How do you tell whether it's a good supplement or not?
That's a question that's very difficult. If it's a dry ketan, it's not good. If it's in an oil, it's better. Q10 is a supplement that, as long as it's in an oil, it's probably going to be okay. And it's probably going to be pretty good. It's a supplement that actually only comes from two factories in the world. So no matter where what it's incorporated in, they're getting it from one of two factories. And both of them say, both those factories say that they're going through some renovation. I think it's more of a cartel. So prices on Q10 have been skyrocketing. They've almost tripled in the last few months. And it's actually very hard to come by. So that's one supplement that's probably not a typical example.
So
vitamin E, you want to get the natural mix tocopherols as opposed to the D-alpha tocopherol. Better to get it if it's not in soybean oil. There it's a kind of a little bit of a hit and miss, where usually you'll get a little bit of benefit, but sometimes buying the cheapest one, you might not be getting the best one at all.
Why is it that you have grapefruit, lemons, limes, citrus, but then you don't have oranges, and that's my favorite fruit.
As far as...
That's the...
Where are you?
Carbohydrates and fish.
Well, there's going to be a new list. This is kind of... Oh, but let me see where you are. Okay, this is in limited quantities. You can't even look at that yet. Okay? Don't even look at that. This is generally not until at least several weeks after eating. You didn't see that. Food's allowed in limited quantities. Not until several weeks after eating. Don't even look at that yet. Not pertinent.
What is several? What is several? Is that two?
How do you get full if you don't like a lot of...
Okay, well, there's two ways to feel satisfied after eating. Okay?
I don't like nuts. I don't like avocados. I don't like olives.
Well, you're in trouble.
You're in trouble.
I just do not like the taste of them. They're not appetizing. They're not good to me. I like the vegetables, the green vegetables, but and okay. I don't like beans.
You don't like beans?
No.
That's fine. You don't. Beans aren't a big part of that. I'm not. Beans are a compromise.
So I'm worried about getting too much protein is what I'm worried about.
Because, yeah, you would just go on a high protein diet. Okay, number one, we don't want you to be full.
Okay.
Okay? There's two ways to be satisfied from eating. One is to be full.
Right.
That's the least effective way.
Okay.
That's kind of the Chinese restaurant syndrome. You know, you go to a Chinese, you get full, and then an hour later you're famished again. That's because all the vegetables fill you up, but you're not getting satiated.
Right.
There's a center in your brain that satiates, that says you're not hungry. And that's a very powerful center. And what you really want to do is become satiated from eating, rather than being full. And satiation comes from hormonal signaling. And that will come much more easily once you keep your leptin and mostly your leptin levels low, until you become leptin sensitive. And when you become both leptin and insulin sensitive, you will then be able to start burning off some of the fat that is being stored. Mm-hmm. And then you're eating when you don't put anything in your mouth, and you'll be satiated, you'll be less hungry. Nobody should eat really until they're full. That's not a good way to appease one's appetite. It should be done via satiation. Also, I've heard from many people, although you might never learn to love nuts, you'll find that your taste changes.
Will change.
Yeah. I mean, what you've been accustomed to liking, you'll change. I mean, I used to love milk.
I don't like milk.
Yeah. I mean, just as an example, I used to love milk. I was just a poster child of the American Dairy Association, but after I stayed away from milk, you could not torture me to drink milk right now. I mean, I hate it, just because I haven't had it for a while. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that a lot of tastes just will change, your desire. So, you might try at first, there's a lot of different kinds of nuts, if you like pistachios or you know, any kind of particular nut that you might like. There are almonds that are, you know, like tamari roasted almonds. There are chili roasted, there are chili covered pistachios. There's lemon chili. Look at in the bulk bins of Whole Foods and they'll have 30 different types of nuts. And sneak a sample here and there. But I, for instance, the lemon chili pistachios are, you know, something unusual, but I think they're really good. You might find you like them. You don't know. You've probably never tried them.
Right, no, I haven't.
So you might try it, and maybe you'll find that that's one you really like.
Okay.
So try it. You know, there are things that you haven't tried very many things of because,
right.
you know, you didn't know you were going to be on
right.
this type of diet, and you had found your desires fulfilled by
right.
other things that
right.
you know were trying to change. So you got to try maybe a different variety of foods. That maybe you'll find something that's appealing. It usually does happen with people.
Okay.
They you know shop around a little bit
okay.
to
okay.
see if you can find something to like.
Shelley Schlender. You've been listening to a weekly meeting of the Boulder Nutrition Think Tank, launched in 2004. For questions about medications, be sure to consult with your primary care physician. Whenever you make a lifestyle change, we urge you to tell your doctor, including about any dietary or supplement changes. The Boulder Nutrition Think Tank is conducted at the Family Learning Center in Boulder, 303-442-8979. Ask for Pilar. To contact Ron Rosedale, check the website therosedalediet.com or call 303-790-8766.